The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Charles W. Cherry II, publisher of the Florida Courier and the Daytona Times. He's also the author of Excellence Without Excuse, The Black Student's Guide to Academic Excellence. Originally published in 1993, it has returned to print and has been re-released as an e-book to celebrate its 20th anniversary. Stick around. Whether you're a black student or a white student, you'll find inspiration in his book and hopefully in this interview. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of television stereotypes of students, including Urkel, Lionel Jefferson, and the cast of A Different World in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. All right. You laughed at that last time. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Charles W. Cherry II didn't have to write a book. He could have swallowed hard on his experiences as an African-American student, good and bad, kept his thoughts to himself, and moved on with his life as a rising young attorney and heir to a black media empire of newspapers and radio stations. But he didn't. Instead, Cherry wrote a book geared to underachieving black students that attempts to teach them the essentials of learning and studying in an education system that often shows blacks little of the mercy and wiggle room that white students encounter. He offers straight talk about gaining confidence and why grades matter, even when it seems like they don't. Most important for a generation of young men and women who may have grown up in, let's say, one-parent or no-parent homes, in neighborhoods struggling to overcome crime or drugs, Cherry provides a voice that many black students have never heard. It says quite simply, yes, you can, yes, you will, and I will show you how. Cherry's message is one that President Obama echoed recently in announcing a new White House outreach initiative aimed at helping young men of color. This is a quote from the president. None of this is going to be easy. It's not a one-year proposition. It's not a two-year proposition. It's going to take time. We're dealing with complicated issues that run deep in our history, run deep in our society, and are entrenched in our lives. I don't know what I typed there, but lives is what he said. So Charles W. Cherry II, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And I will say this publicly. Charles is here for the second time, even though you'll never find that first interview. it died on a hard drive, and so we're back, and he's a very patient guy. And thank you for doing this again.
Sure. If at some point we blow up and go get on Oprah, then they'll be looking for the lost interview.
I know. I'll send them to
money, so we'll find it.
We'll send them to Seagate. Let them work it out. Charles, I don't know. Well, this is a lie. I do sort of know a little about your politics because we talked about this before. But what did you think of the president's new initiative for those who didn't get to see you the first time?
Well, the president's new initiative is a start. I'm encouraged and I'm disappointed simultaneously. I'm encouraged because finally, after six and a half years in the White House, he did finally begin to address the issue, and particularly what I call a disproportionate amount of pain that black people suffer in America, regardless of the category. I'm glad that he mentioned it. I'm disappointed because there's no force of law, there's no policy behind it. Essentially, what he's doing is that he's trying to depend on the largesse of large companies and on the nonprofit side, the nonprofit sector, to really deal with the problem that comes as a consequence of 200 to 250 years of racist government policies and practices. And I mean, it'll be a good thing, I guess, when he gets out of the White House, or something that he can work on, you know, out of a sense of passion. But we don't know how long it's going to last after, because there's no budget function to it. There's no law, you know. It's just another one of the initiatives that he takes a personal interest in. Once that personal interest is gone, or once he's out of office, what happens?
Well, I mean, how else could he have done this? In terms of he's been fighting 4 years, I guess. I mean, the first 2 years he had a Congress that was all Democratic, and he didn't attempt to get this through. The last 4 years he's been dealing. 3.5 years, if you will, he's been dealing with a Congress that says no. He says the sky is blue. They say no, it's not. He says, you know, I have to go to the bathroom. They say no, you don't. I mean, what would you have had him done differently?
Well, Paul, I think part and parcel would be to take advantage of the fact that you do have. I mean, I know you had a long list of things to do in the first 2 years when you had essentially control. Through all three branches of the three components of two of the three components of the government. Mm-hmm. So I would have said move it up on your to-do list, even as far as the successful but problematic rollout of Obamacare. I would have said focus on jobs, and jobs to me and education go hand in hand. If you have jobs that folks who are college dropouts, who have problems with the criminal justice system, can get in the inner city, then that problem begins to not solve itself. But you go a long way toward getting an at-risk population that now he's using this initiative to help. You know, you have the force of government law and action behind that. So I know he had a long list of things to do. I know he didn't think that they were going to lose the House at the midterm. So I know going back and looking back at it, sort of 20/20 hindsight. But from my perspective, anything that deals with race is quotation marks, even if it's perceived to be addressing, again, the proven disproportionate pain that black people are in terms of morbidity, mortality, foreclosures, impact of the 2008 market crash, all these things. Black people and people of color have suffered disproportionately more than anybody else. And it seems to me that the whole issue of triage in the government should have been at play, which is the people who are hurt the most are the people who deserve the help, and that was just never done.
I would agree. By the way, I just so you know, I agree with your sense of priorities. I still think when he's remembered in years to come, it will be for focusing on healthcare when he should have been focusing on jobs. Mm-hmm. Because if he had gotten a couple million more people employed those first 2 years while he had control of Congress, he wouldn't have lost. I don't think he would have lost control of Congress, frankly. Mm-hmm. People vote with their wallets and they vote with their stomachs. And if their wallets are full and their tummies are full, you know, they're going to support you. And healthcare, I think it's completely admirable. I'm glad it got done. I don't think coming into that huge recession and everything falling apart, healthcare was the number one priority in the country at the time. So I agree with you. Do you think one more question about that? Though, do you think that he went this route of relying on the setting up this initiative and relying on corporations because he thought it would be more lasting than if in 2 years a very conservative Republican becomes president and comes in and says, you know what, I ain't feeling that law, that policy, I'm going to dump it. But if he's got these corporations behind it, there's actually going to be more pressure on them from the public to keep this going than there will be on Congress to keep.
Well, I think that the corporations, I'm a small business person. Essentially, the first thing, the goal usually when you start, if a corporation runs into trouble, are your personnel costs and whatever is not a core function mm-hmm. of the company. So I would think that if these corporations, these big companies run into trouble, that'll be the first thing that they'll be gone. The function of a corporation essentially is to make money for the shareholders. And a nonprofit in and of itself, no matter how philanthropic the motives may be, is not something that adds anything to a corporate bottom line. Mm-hmm. So I think he went to the corporations because that's who his friends are.
Okay.
I mean, he's no, you know, that's the only place he could go. He's not a small business guy. He, you know, any of the business initiatives of the White House don't focus on small business. They focus on large Wall Street corporations. Mm. And so I think he went where he could go. And the other issue that the other problem that I have with it is that he didn't go out and sort of have a round robin and a, you know, come to Jesus meeting with the folks who are out there doing the work. A lot of the a whole lot of people that I know that are underfunded, undercapitalized, but are doing this out of a sense of mission, and particularly in Black communities all over the country, never heard from the White House. There was never an email saying, "Hey, look, we're putting together something. We need your input. Can you meet with us? Can you Skype with us? Can you send us a list of what you're doing? What you think is going to be successful?" That's not what was done.
A lot of the complaints about this president over the years have been that he doesn't communicate with anybody. Congress says we don't hear from him. You know, the Senate. Obviously, you're not impressed with that aspect of his communication. No. But let me ask you this. In the book, I wonder if this is a little bit of a contradiction, although I think I kind of understand it. In the book, you complain a lot about government programs over the years that have been ostensibly aimed, or for public relations purposes perhaps, aimed at helping Black community, but ultimately caused more pain or were more difficult. But here you are with an African-American president wanting him to do things legislatively. Is there some contradiction there? Or?
I don't think it's a contradiction. I think that what I asked the president to do was essentially begin to unwind the impact of a lot of the policies of you know, redlining and unequal division of resources and for loans and other things that have been part and parcel of the American legal system and policy for decades. And I think that he was in a unique position, not just to begin to make the changes, but also to make part of it. Is you got to make the argument. Nobody's made the argument that here is why this is necessary. Let's look from a historical perspective. Why do you have ghettos around in high density Black population areas all over this country? Well, because the areas were redlined. And loans were not made from FHA loans and so on and so forth were not made to these particular areas because they were redlined by the federal government. That was part and parcel of government policy. So you can't say the government is part of the problem, but the government is not part of the solution. Now, let's go back to my complaints. The complaints that I make were about the government was that, again, just as in his educational initiative, Black Male Educational Initiative, you don't ask the people who are impacted by the policies or who are doing the hard work to reverse some of the policies on what the government should be doing. Why don't you ask before you throw millions of dollars into different kinds of programs? Ask the people what do you need? What are you looking for? Let's sit down but Black people generally are not considered to be peers. You know, we were always historically, you know, I think of people to be sort of managed or to be reckoned with, but not citizens who are part and parcel of what we believe is a great democracy in this country. I don't think it's, you know, just me talking. You know, sort of justifying what I've written, but I don't think it's necessarily a contradiction. And perhaps there is a double standard for the president. He's Black, and you would hope that he's smart. He understands the history of this nation. You would think that as a key historical figure, that he could at least make the argument. But he and his administration advisors have obviously decided that anything that deals with race in any tangential manner is not to be mentioned. And I'll tell you one other thing. When we were doing stories for the Florida Courier, running up to his first term. Black people, I think, sort of understood that, well, he's not going to do much for the first term because he's got to be reelected. So the whole story, the narrative in many Black communities, as we do sort of kitchen table or water cooler talk, was he needs to get elected. He needs to focus on the entire country. And then he'll begin to deal with some of our issues during his second term. And from my perspective, that has yet to happen. And because now you don't have control of the branches of government that you need to, on the legislative side, there's a possibility of losing the Senate. So now you become truly a lame duck. And then, so, you know, people are asking themselves in the barbershops, you know, were we bamboozled? I mean, we said we wait, and we some of the issues that have gotten that haven't gotten done, the incarceration epidemic in black areas in the country, the we still suffering from the lack of the loss of wealth during the foreclosure crisis, so there are a lot of issues that he probably will not get a chance to address because of the circumstances that exist right now. And I think that looking back, he's probably going to be more of a transitional president rather than sort of the transformational president perhaps he thought he was going to be. Mm-hmm. So I think he transitioned the country essentially from the Bush years and from two wars and from the economic meltdown and the real estate collapse and so on and so forth. So now you're in a recovery that's limping along, but the bottom didn't fall out for the country. So I think that if history will probably see him as helping the country to ease its way through sort of globalization and some of the things that are going on now to whatever else is going to be next.
As usual, Democrats always find a way to self-destruct. I mean, you know, it's the history of the party, right? You got a president in office, you don't support. I mean, I don't mean you, but I mean the party doesn't support him. The people in office don't support him. They've run away from health care, the one big accomplishment that he certainly had. I mean, he's put an end to the two wars and the recession. They run from the poor guy,
yes,
giving themselves no hope of holding on or gaining back the House and yes, possibly losing. It's just pathetic. I don't know.
You know, always running scared. In the meantime, the Republicans, even though they're split for the first time in quite a while between the sort of moderate and moderate in quotation marks, moderate in reference to the Tea Party.
Right.
But then now you have a Supreme Court that is essentially saying, hey, you know, let's make it rain on the political system. If you got money, I mean, there's no limits. And even yesterday with this McCutcheon decision, mm-hmm, it goes right into the Citizens United. And after a while, I mean, our votes will mean nothing. It'll mean nothing. And I don't see that as the way the country ought to be going.
I agree. All right. Well, look. Let's. We came to talk about the student book. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Obama proposal because it seemed relative. I'm glad we talked about it. But let's go back to your experience as a African American student in high school and college. Can you tell folks a little bit about what kind of led up to you wanting to write this book?
Well, there were a couple of things. There two things that happened. One, after my education, my formal education ended at the University of Florida. I was in, and let me go back, let me start from where I started. Sure. From first to fourth grade, I was in a segregated all-black elementary school, got a great education there. My mother was, in fact, a sixth grade teacher, and then my house was right across the street from where I went to elementary school. My father was a civil rights activist in the state, and then there was a push on back then to make the Florida school systems obey the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And this was 10 years after the decision had been made. So,
Florida's a little slow, folks. Florida's a little slow.
Yeah. Yes, you could say that, Bob. So 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, Florida decides that it would spitefully desegregate the school system. What they did essentially was to shut down all the black schools, take the teachers out, take the principals out, and then scatter the kids all over the schools by busing them every place. So my parents felt like that was not going to be good for me. So in fifth through eighth grade, ninth grade, I went to a Catholic school. Did perform well. My background in the all black school prepared me very well to be an A student. So I was an A student. From there through the public high schools to through Morehouse College, where I was a journalism major. And then I reached a roadblock when I got to the University of Florida. I was in a master's degree, master's of business administration, and a law degree program simultaneously. And the amount of material that I was called on to study, and then trying to learn a couple of different languages at the same time, you know, I flunked a course. I remember an accounting course that I flunked after I studied days for it, and I was pretty much devastated. That was the first year I was in the MBA program, and that was sort of a key factor in I think a key roadblock that I had to cross. I had to make up my mind that I was going to get my degree no matter what. And so as I sat down and did sort of self-assessment, I knew I had to retool, you know, the things that I had learned about studying. And so I did start doing research on time management, goal setting, you know, memorization and all the rest of this stuff. And then sort of put together my own little system that I was successfully able to utilize for the four and a half years I was at the University of Florida. So once I graduated from there, got the law degree, passed the bar, I came to South Florida. I was a prosecutor here for about 2 years. Most of the guys I was prosecuting were young and black. And when I do pre-sentence investigations, we find out they came from good households, they came from, you know, had good parents, so on and so forth. But the key was that they did not know how to navigate through the education system. A lot of them had trouble in school. And it wasn't because they weren't smart. It was because they didn't understand that there's a system in play that you have to learn to navigate through the system. And they didn't have the skills to do that. So I got out of state attorney's office and then started looking back on my experience. And then that's where Excellence Without Excuse comes from. From my experience as a black student in a predominantly white a huge school that was completely opposite culturally of my undergrad experience. And then my seeing the difficulty that black students had in navigating through this public education system and then ending up as dropouts or whatever and then ending up in the criminal justice system.
Now, my sense, and I think you'll agree, you did not come from any kind of an underprivileged background at all. Your family was successful; it was in business, the media companies, and such. But reading the book, I think whether you're white or black, you get a sense that there's a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. And is that as a result of your time, for example, as a prosecutor, and you were seeing what was happening? Less so than what actually happened to you in college, or is it your own college experience as well at Florida?
I think most of it comes from the experience at the University of Florida at the time. I was angry about the fact that I wasn't accepted and I go back to the first day in my constitutional law class. One of my classmates raised her hand and said that we know that, I know, she's talking about herself, I know that there are people here who are here on affirmative action. And I don't understand why they would feel that they really deserved to be here, and I don't understand why they are here. And that was sort of the attitude of some of the classmates and even some of the instructors, understand at the time, University of Florida had entered a consent decree, I believe, with the federal government that indicated that they had to bring black students in. So I came in during that affirmative action period. But what we all black students want folks to know was that all it did was give us a chance. We got into place, but we had to stay. And so, you get a chance to come in and produce, but they didn't give away any grades when I was there. I mean, every A, B, or C that I earned, I earned it. And affirmative action was something that was a chip on my shoulder because of the hostility that some of the instructors and the teachers, that my fellow classmates had, that black students shouldn't even be in the school at that point in time.
And it's weird. We've talked about this off the air. I mean, we were at Gainesville at University of Florida at the same time. You were in graduate school, I was a lowly undergraduate. But I honestly had no idea. I had no sense of any of this going on. I don't know how I would have. Probably wasn't being covered a lot in the Alligator, for example. But
no.
do you think? You write pretty straightforwardly in the book about your experiences, and are you surprised that other African Americans haven't written similarly, or have I missed a whole genre of book?
I think there are a few books out there talking about that era, but not many. Mm. I think most folks just brushed it off the shoulders and went on. It was just part and parcel of the landscape, that the academic landscape at that time. And I think those who didn't make it through, and there I know some folks who did not make it through University of Florida once they were admitted there, don't talk about that experience. And those of us who do who have made it, it's just a war story. So, I decided at that point in time, the time that I wrote it, that it was an unnecessary experience, and that I wanted to make sure that the sort of the culture shock, the amount of material, all the kinds of things, the mental changes that I went through, I wanted to at least give other Black students the understanding of what sort of lay before them and what they could do before they got there to make it easy on themselves. It's not just from the culture perspective, but of course from the academic preparations and the skills base, because a lot of what I talk about is skills based. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's race neutral skills. I mean, you know, the human brain works the same way. I mean, if we could all study by osmosis, everybody would be walking around with lumps on the head, because you could hit yourself with the book, and then the knowledge would transfer. But time management, the goal setting, how to take notes, outlining, all those things, the good English skills, the writing skills that you have to have, all those are race neutral kind of skills. But I just felt that they were not being given to Black students with an understanding of this is what you must do in order to succeed. Mm.
Well, and you know, we've talked a lot about the politics and culture that kind of underlie the book. But this is, I mean, what I really like about the book is what you're getting at here is that you say that there are right people and wrong people of all colors. And you put the onus on the readers of the book to take responsibility for their own track and their own education and do it right. I mean, right? I mean, that's the essence of it.
Nobody cares for the most part, whether you succeed or fail. You got to take them, and then you've got to control what you can control, and then leave up to God, to Allah, to the universe, to the force, the rest. And so that's what we talk about. There was a quote by Patricia Rush McCloud that I always remember, which is that some people are of your color that may not be of your kind, and some people are of your kind that may not be of your color, which means that there are people all over who will help you, particularly in the academic perspective. If people want to see effort, people want to, if you're struggling, people want to see you struggle and not give up. And so knowing that that is the case a lot of times can get you the extra credit, the extra help in these big academic environments that are very impersonal. So a lot of what I talk about is being able to put to first of all, yeah, you have to absorb the material. Try to absorb the material, and you have to show effort. If you don't show effort in academics, nobody's going to come to your aid, and that's what you need. People are going to put the burden and responsibility on you, because academics is selfish that way. I mean, you can only learn for yourself. I can't learn for my 14-year-old. I can't learn for my – they have to learn for themselves. That's just the way the human brain is built.
Well, and I've tried to express this to my daughter and other kids over the years that, you know, you can go to the school. You can hate whatever school you're at. You can hate the teachers. But if you tell me you can't learn anything there, I don't buy that, no matter almost what the school is. I mean, the books are in front of you. The classes are being taught every day. You have to make the decision as a student. Are you going to absorb it? Are you going to pay attention? Are you going to try to figure out where it connects to your life and get through it? And, you know, there's bare minimums that you need to do. If you're not willing to do that, then no, you're not going to learn and you're not going to succeed. And that doesn't matter if you're white or black, you're Chinese, you're Indian, you're you're
And one other thing, Bob, that we talked about I want to mention is that one – problem that I have with the American education system is that it doesn't start with the student. It doesn't start with what a kid wants to do. So we do a very poor job of connecting the things that we are teaching kids in the school system to what they want to do with themselves. And part and parcel, I think, of one of the starting blocks of Excellence Without Excuse is goal setting. And so we take the students through a system actually that I got from Zig Ziglar, and it talks about starting with a wild ideas list. What is it that whatever that you want to be, do, or have? That's what you start with. And then once you begin, we know where they're going to end up, which is that whatever you want to do, whatever you want to have, whatever you want to be is related in some way to education. And so the basics of education are assisting you in trying to get where you want to go. And I think when if we were to help the kids sort of to make that connection that we already know is there, that will give them sort of the more the internal motivation to move forward with education, particularly when it becomes more difficult. Mm-hmm. So if you want, I mean, let's say a black kid wants to be a rapper, you want to be a football player. Okay, what's related to that? You want to be a rapper, you need to learn English. You need to learn, you know, journalism. There are certain skills. You know, if you want to be a musician, there's mathematics, because music is mathematics. If you want to be a football player, then there's kinesiology, there's biology. You know, there are things that are associated with whatever it is that you want to do. But I think we have to use a little bit more imagination as rational adults to try to tie it in. So that they get the motivation primarily has to be internal, mm-hmm. for you to be able to do the things that you want to do. Nobody's going to beat you, and all these other. You have to have the internal motivation to move yourself forward. Once you sort of figure out there's a path to where you want to go.
How about that even more basic skill that I'm afraid we don't teach? And that's if you want to be an athlete or an artist or a musician, whatever it may be, like that. You also need to know that. You cannot spend more money than you have coming in.
That's right.
you have to save for a rainy day. As hard as it is when you're 21, think you're going to live forever and the money's going to keep coming. We need to do a better job of teaching all these kids that.
That's right. So that's mathematics, it's finance, it's business, it's accounting, it's those types of things. And actually, that's a life skill. We probably should have a required life skills curriculum at some point. In American education system, I would put voting and tax paying and all, you know, other kinds of things, you know, staying away from debt or trying to use debt judiciously. Those kinds of things are the kinds of things that kids should be taught at an early level.
I agree. You encourage your student readers to do a self-assessment about midway through the book. You challenge them to answer a series of questions that include things like, what strengths and weaknesses do I have academically? What are my personality traits? Am I highly motivated to achieve the academic goals I've set for myself? And this is a good one. Am I willing to throw out bad habits that I am comfortable with, if necessary, to achieve my academic goals? I've got a couple more here, folks. Where does finishing school fit on my list of life's priorities? Am I willing to sweat to achieve my academic goals? Am I willing to sacrifice ego and control over my academic life in order to achieve success? I mean, you know, it's hard to hit an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid over the head with these things because they're not prepared to think about it. But the reality is, if we don't, again, and this I really think these issues cross race, which is why I was really interested in the book. You gotta have some common sense. You gotta, mm-hmm. we gotta beat into their heads that this is the only way you're going to survive and yep. succeed.
Yep. And the other thing is, somebody's paying for this education. Either I'm paying for it as a taxpayer, or a parent, your parents paying for it, or you're going into debt for it. Mm-hmm. So this is not playtime. So I partied, and in the book we talk about the fact that you can do all these things and not miss a party. I open a lot of them, I close a lot of them, but you have to, if you're not going to understand that there's a certain amount of discipline, there's a large degree of discipline that you have to be able to get through, especially when you get to the college level, mm-hmm. where you got skin on the table. And if you don't do what you're supposed to do, then you're going to get on the other side and it's going to be a bad decision. So the other thing we talk about is making good decisions. Every person and particularly every child has to understand that there's a decision-making process that we're making on a day-to-day basis, almost minute to minute. If you're alive in the morning, you have to decide if you're going to put your feet on the ground, on the floor, and then get up at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. As a student, particularly in college, You know, all you got is an alarm clock. Mom and dad's not going to come and knock on the door and say, okay, time to get up, cook you breakfast, and so on and so forth. So you have to start asking yourself hard questions. And from my perspective, the earlier you ask yourself those questions at a student, the better.
Yeah. So before we kind of wrap up, what prompted you to bring this book back into print or e-print, as e-book as the case may be, after 20 years?
It was by popular demand. I'm a perfectionist with regard to writing. For almost every year, the last 4 or 5 years, I've thought about completely rewriting the book. But people, and then I let it go out of, here's what happened. I let it go out of print maybe 10 years ago when we got deeply into media ownership. And I would always run into people who had, and just last week I ran into somebody who's now 30 years old who said, are you Charles Cherry? Yes. I got your book. It helped me through undergrad. What's going on with it? And I told it was back out in print. But I ran into those kind of people throughout the years. And what I would tell them was, well, I let it go because I felt like it was sort of dated. It was pre-computer and so on and so forth. They said, but the skills and that you focus on are not dated. They're universal and they're timeless. So why don't you just get it back out there, get in the hands of the kids, they can, and then just go and talk about it. So that's what I decided to do. So the only thing I changed from the original edition was the introduction, and sort of bring that up to date. So we talk about what's happened to me in the meantime. We put it in sort of the context of the Obama era. But I didn't change it. I didn't change except for a few typos. It hasn't changed from the original version, so which is why we call it the classic version.
Got it. Well, in the essence of it, I maintain you don't have to be black to appreciate the essence of what's in this book. Yeah. Any parent who may see this and has a kid that's struggling a bit for whatever reason, it's a good book to lay your hands on and pick out the essence that applies to your kid.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. And folks, you can order Charles W. Cherry II's book, Excellence Without Excuse, The Black Student's Guide to Academic Excellence, at great online bookstores, or you can order it right now here on MrMedia.com at a great price. If you're watching on MrMedia.com, look below the video, probably over there or maybe over there. You'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. You can have it delivered immediately to your Kindle as an ebook, or you can. I think there may still be physical copies that you can order as well.
Yes.
You can get it that way. Charles, what about a website or Facebook, Twitter? You on any of that kind of stuff?
Yes, website is excellencewithoutexcuse.com, no spaces, so excellencewithoutexcuse.com. Twitter, ccherry2, C-C-H-E-R-R-Y-2. And you can get me at Charles Cherry, just look for Charles Cherry on Facebook.
All right. Well, you're a fascinating man to talk to. I think we talked the last time. I have a little history with family. I believe we decided it was your brother, perhaps, or your
brother.
Your brother. Mm-hmm. I hope he's well, and I hope the rest of your family's well. And thank you very much for your patience and having to go through this a second time, but just as interesting, just as glad to have you here. And Charles, thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by The Realm Network.